and welcome to our latest Global Regulation Tomorrow Plus podcast on the FCA's proposals on diversity and inclusion in the financial sector. My name is Simon Lovegrove, and I'm the Global Director of Financial Services Knowledge here at North Rose Fulbright. Today, I'm very pleased to be joined by Hannah Meakin and Hannah McCaslin-Schaff from North Rose Fulbright's London Financial Services team, and also Alistair Scott from GP Strategies. GP Strategies is a talent transformation provider that delivers award-winning learning and development solutions, which helps organizations transform through their people and achieve meaningful change via learning. In this podcast, we're going to cover inclusivity, how well contributions, presence, and perspectives of different groups of people are valued and integrated into the environment. In its recent consultation paper on diversity and inclusion, CP2320, the FCA noted that inclusivity is a particularly important topic given that it can reduce the risk of groupthink, which can lead to weak governance and a failure to act in the customer's best interests. In terms of inclusivity, I'd like to start with the inclusion expectation and advantage in 2024. Perhaps, Alistair, you could take us through this.
Sure. So briefly, for those listeners who are not familiar with these concepts, the inclusion advantage relates to the continued business case surrounding DE&I efforts, which proves the ongoing benefit of investing in this form of working culture. Well, the latter, the inclusion expectation, refers to how recent events such as the COVID-19 pandemic or other societal movements have provoked certain expectations of organizational culture and organizations' responsibility for positively impacting their people. And now, there have been a number of studies concerning the inclusion expectation and the advantage, which some of those listening may be familiar with. So I'll start with the inclusion expectation and then unpack the advantage of inclusion in today's workplace. The inclusion expectation has been consistently proven in recent research across the employee lifecycle. In 2020, Glassdoor found that 76% of job seekers reported that an inclusive workplace is an important factor when evaluating companies and job offers. Also in 2020, a study by Deloitte found that 47% of employees look for a workplace atmosphere where they can be their authentic selves. Both of these statistics, plus many more that we could showcase, demonstrate the desire to work within a specific working culture, one that fosters respect, humility, and looks to cater for the unique needs and requirements of a diverse workforce. Now, over the past 15 years, there have also been numerous studies that have showcased the reality of the inclusion advantage, where inclusion provides organizations with a competitive advantage. Studies continue to demonstrate this. For example, as recently as 2023, a McKinsey report titled Diversity Matters Even More found that organizations with parity in gender and ethnicity representation in senior roles, well, they saw profit levels 39% higher than their peers. Importantly, though, diverse representation is not enough to automatically realize this kind of profit differentiation. It happens when diverse employees at all levels are anticipated and catered for, where all perspectives are sought and heard, and decisions are made collectively. This is inclusion, and this is what statistics illustrating the inclusion advantage really reflect.
Thanks, Alistair. That's some very interesting statistics. And in the regulatory sector, I'm always reminded of the often cited CAS Business School research, where it suggested that greater gender diversity improves risk management culture and decreases the frequency of European banks' misconduct fines. In addition to risk management, there are other inclusion advantages in the regulatory space. Hannah McCaslin-Schaff, do you want to briefly say a few words about these?
Thanks, Simon. I think there have been studies which support the business case for inclusive cultures leading to increased profitability, creativity, and innovation. Inclusivity also supports an environment where challenging the status quo is commonplace, and this leads to better internal governance, decision-making, and risk management. When you look at the FCA's proposals, they are focusing not only on diversity, but also inclusion. For instance, for larger firms, when it comes to data, the FCA is talking about inclusion metrics and targets via a regulatory return. The data on inclusion metrics would be a significant indicator for the FCA of a firm's culture. The inclusion metrics are covered in the consultation and include whether employees feel safe to speak up if they observe inappropriate behaviour or misconduct. The FCA goes on to say in its consultation that data on inclusion must be captured on an anonymous and voluntary basis and should always include a response option to prefer not to say. Responses to the questions on inclusion would also need to be reported on the three layers being board, senior leadership and all employees. The FCA has said in the consultation that it will require firms to disclose the number of employees who choose the prefer not to say option when responding to the inclusion questions. It also suggests that a higher number of employees selecting this option may indicate a poor culture within the firm due to a lack of openness and honesty. Some have questioned this, and it will be interesting to see what the FCA says in its policy statement.
Thank you, Hannah. Yes, indeed. It will be very interesting to see what the FCA says in its policy statement. We just touched on inappropriate behaviour and misconduct, and I just wanted to touch on the recent sexism in the Citi inquiry. Firms in the financial services sector should realise the benefits that diversity and inclusivity bring, but it's taken the regulators to intervene, issuing a consultation setting out proposed standards. What do you think, Hannah Meakin?
Thanks, Simon. I mean, we do see many of our clients working extremely hard on diversity and inclusion issues, although I think the general feeling is that there is still more that can and should be done. And indeed, the FCA's CEO argued at the recent inquiry that talent is not progressing as one might expect, whether that's female talent, minority ethnic talent, or indeed other characteristics. I also think that Sarah Pritchard in the inquiry covered the point regarding the FCA's and the PRA's intervention quite nicely when she stated that industry had prompted that intervention so that there could be more comparisons and benchmarks between the entire industry in circumstances where there's currently not that much coherence or consistency, making it difficult to compare like for like. That's why one of the key elements of the proposals is, I think, transparency in data reporting so that the regulator has consistent aggregate data by which firms can evaluate themselves. And that data and information would also give the regulator the ability to target firms where it wants to take more follow-up action. We've been through the proposals in previous podcasts, so we're not going to go through them again today. But in terms of behaviour, I think it's worth reminding everyone something that the inquiry touched on, this being the issue of rolling bad apples, so people who move from role to role whilst repeatedly committing non-financial misconduct. The proposals that have been published seek to prevent this issue by making it clear that any information that's relevant to fitness and propriety ought to be disclosed in regulatory references. So anyone who is anticipating the possibility of moving into a new role in the next 6 years that either requires senior management approval or fitness and propriety assessment, we should be expecting that any instances of financial or non-financial misconduct would be recorded. And hopefully this will help to deal with the bad apples. One other thing to pick up on since our last podcast is that the FCA is surveying wholesale banks and wholesale insurers to look at numbers and statistics of non-financial misconduct cases in that part of the financial services sector, as well as at methods of detection and methods of resolution. So while there is an argument that in order to get a properly holistic view, it would have been good to maybe look at a kind of wider breadth of firms, I think this is still an important exercise. And the FCA will be able to use this data to take stock and share best practice. And these surveys will also inform the FCA's supervisory programme when the new rules come into place.
Thanks, Hannah. I've seen reports in the media that some have argued that surveys will never fully capture the scale of the problem, but let's wait and see what the outcome is. The FCA has said that it will publish the survey questions alongside its key findings in the second half of 2024. I just want to finish the podcast by focusing on inclusion actions, essentially a what can we do section to inform listeners of the inclusive design measures and principles that they can adopt to A, meet the FCA's obligations, and also B, evolve beyond them to foster cultures that are inclusive and psychologically safe. These can be either behavioural recommendations or more systemic design recommendations. Perhaps, Alistair, I could draw you back in and you could give us your thoughts.
Sure, absolutely. There are a number of things that firms and individuals can do to embed inclusive practices and values into our ways of working. So, for instance, firms need to think about how inclusion is used as a key design principle in overall workplace design. So how roles are designed, how processes such as hiring and performance management avoid adverse impact of minority communities, and also how they achieve equity, also how policies explicitly anticipate a wider profile of individuals, not just the assumed individuals that are present within our communities and within the sector. The tone on from the top is also incredibly important. The firm's senior leadership need to be role models in their own people management and also actively and visibly champion inclusion activities. Policies and practices will also need to be reviewed when the regulators finalise their rules, and some thinking will need to be done as to how these can be communicated. Aside from formal processes, though, firms should also think about the informal mechanisms to allow employees to feel like they have a say within the firm. So regular anonymous pulse surveys, focus groups, Q&A events, and empowered and funded resource groups are all examples of how individuals can advocate for themselves, their communities, or those they look to amplify and support.
And also giving a voice to dissenting voices.
Oh, absolutely. That is important too. I mean, feedback from a firm's DEI strategy from employees and wider stakeholders can provide valuable insights, identifying both strengths and opportunities for change. I mean, many firms now use pulse surveys, like I recommended, to collect feedback internally and social listening externally. It really is important for dissenting voices to be heard, to pinpoint root causes for any roadblocks, and contribute towards optimising the impact of the DEI strategy.
Thanks, Alistair. Hannah McCaslin-Schaff, I know you've been looking at this whole topic a lot. I just wondered if you've had any further thoughts.
Thanks, Simon. Just one thing I thought it might be useful to flag was the internal survey point. While some firms do aim to measure inclusion through staff surveys, and this is an important metric for firms to consider as part of their overall approach to D&I data, many in the market believe it's unlikely the data prescribed by the FCA's new rules will tell the full story. So perhaps firms might be thinking about how much more they can learn and how much more progress they can make if they broaden the data they collect. Another big issue here is obviously employee participation. Many firms have told us that they want to do more, but are held back by low employee declaration rates. More often than not, firms with the best declaration rates have worked hard to achieve this, with focused initiatives to build trust and understanding amongst staff. These included HR teams running dedicated sessions to explain how the data is used and what insights they have already gleaned from it, and showcasing how easy completing the data form can be. Simple measures can make a big difference.
Thanks, Hannah. Very true. Simple measures can make a very big difference. My thanks to both Hannah's and also to Alistair for sharing their thoughts today. Please look out for further updates on this topic on our Regulation Tomorrow blog and also on our DE&I Hub located on the Norton Rose Fulbright website. If you would like to discuss anything we've covered today, then please do contact any of our speakers. Many thanks for listening. That concludes this podcast. Goodbye.